This episode is brought to you by Podomatic, the easiest way for podcast fans to become podcasters. Go to podomatic.com or search Podomatic in your app store to start your own podcast for free and find your audience. Hello and welcome to episode number 357 of the Super Horror Bros podcast. I'm your host Matt, and joining me as always is my brother Mike.
Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good.
We are back, not with a horror film this week, funny enough. Right off the bat, we're just having a bit of fun this week. Because we've been on the grind for a while.
There's only so many like 3-hour movies you can watch in your spare time as well as doing the podcast movie, so it had to overlap at some point.
Yeah, especially because the two that we have on the back burner right now to actually watch for the podcast, one of them's 2.5 hours, the other one is 3 hours. So there's no quick movies right now. But also, as I was going to say, like, we've been on the grind for a while. We've been covering the new horror pretty directly this year. And, we've seen a lot of stuff that hasn't been great. We've seen some good stuff as well, of course. But I feel like sometimes we need these. We need to be less bullish and just diving headfirst week after week. Because we used to do this back in the day. Like, I remember when we saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and stuff like that. We had that as like a palate cleanser before Fright Fest 1 year, which was a great shout. And I think this is just such an interesting movie as well that I'm sure people will enjoy the conversation. But yeah, if you're just into the horror, obviously, there is some good horror news here to kick things off. Because there's two kind of notable items here about two pretty big movies coming later this year. This first one is obviously something that we've been eagerly anticipating. We haven't got a trailer yet, but we do have some details on the upcoming Saw movie. Obviously the 10th Saw movie, Saw X, is actually coming sooner than we expected. It's been brought forward a month. So it's now coming out September 29th. Which is always hilarious. Like, Saw has continually bitched out of the Halloween slot when there's even a hint of competition, which there is this year, which we'll get to, in fact, in the second news item, is a movie that's coming out of Halloween. But it just makes me laugh, because Saw, back when it was good, back in the glory days of Saw, specifically those first 6 movies, they owned Halloween.
Yeah, they didn't give a shit.
Yeah, and they weren't the only movie coming out, but they didn't care. They just went in, and they had the confidence because they knew that the films would back it up. Whereas now they're so panicky because they've had such shaky box offices, and obviously the films have been atrocious as well. That it does annoy me. Like, it's another one of those small things, much like Fright Fest, the news we discussed last week. Like, yeah, it doesn't matter when it comes out. If it's a good film, it's a good film. But it's just optics, and it's what you see as a fan from the outside before you've even seen the film. And they said this, it was well over a year ago that we knew this was coming out in Halloween. Like, they said it so preposterously early to try and lock that in, but then again, the moment there's a bit of competition, they just run away. And especially what we're seeing right now at the box office, we're seeing one of the best sort of battles head to head that we've ever seen, really. And it kind of resulted in one of the busiest cinemas we've ever seen, literally ever. Of course, with Barbie and Oppenheimer. And, like, it's crazy. Both movies are doing exceptionally well. Barbie's doing ridiculously well. It's beating Oppenheimer like 2-1, both domestically and internationally, which is crazy. But they're both doing sensational. Obviously, Mission Impossible just came out the week before as well. So I think it breeds competition. So I don't get why they would do this anyway. But alas, we're obviously going to be seeing it sooner rather than later. But the real news here is we've got some plot details for the first time. Obviously, we know that this is the return of Tobin Bell to the franchise. It's kind of the big selling point. Obviously, Shawnee Smith as well has been confirmed for this movie, though she's not in this write-up here. Which makes me think this is one of those cases and they're going to try and see if we forget that they announced that like a year ago. I'm curious if she'll be in the trailer, which I'm sure is just around the corner now. It was all the talk that we were going to be getting a trailer by the end of July. And obviously with it coming out sooner as well, they've got to start promoting this thing. But in the write-up, there's a couple of small tidbits here. via Deadline. The first one is kind of the tagline, which they say, in the Twisted Pictures next installment, John Kramer, a.k.a. Tobin Bell, is back, and it's the untold chapter of Jigsaw's final games. Nice. Which I'm trying to not be negative here. I'm really trying, and especially when we get to the next item as well. But, like, that already annoyed me. Where it's like the untold chapter of Jigsaw's final games, like what you mean Saw 3? Like, we got to see Jigsaw's final game. It was amazing. The movie was amazing. So this does frustrate me no end. But then to get a kind of a bit more, and this is when we actually get into what this film is going to be about, and then I'll throw over to you for your initial reaction for this one.
You're right.
Set between the events of Saw 1 and 2.
You're right.
Which is already, it's just crazy what we're even saying, given how far away we are from that film. You know, we're nearly 20 years away from Saw 1 at this point, and now we're going to just try and slot back into that timeline. But yeah, set between the events of Saw 1 and 2, a sick and desperate John travels to Mexico for a risky and experimental medical procedure in hopes of a miracle cure for his cancer, only to discover the entire operation is a scam to defraud the most vulnerable. The infamous killer returns to his work, turning the tables on the con artist in his signature visceral way through devious, deranged, and ingenious traps.
I didn't want to buy, but then that triggered me on different levels where I need to buy. I'm so angry.
Yeah, I had this last week, so I've kind of cooled a bit.
Like, don't get me wrong, it's already preposterous, but like, the whole point of Jigsaw is kind of that he's accepted his fate and he just wants to, like, you know, do as much as he can in the time he's got. Like, This like last ditch attempt to save himself just seems the opposite to his MO for the rest of the movies.
If it's after Saw One, yeah, that is weird.
Yeah, like it's after Saw One, and so he's like desperately still trying to like cure himself. You know, I mean, I get it. You know, you'd like to think people, you know, he does want to keep going, but it just kind of like, you know, it didn't feel like that in the other movies that he was like, you know, he was kind of accepting of his fate. That was kind of the point. It's why he became Jigsaw.
Yeah, that is weird. Like, we've obviously seen through flashbacks and through the other movies, like, different time periods. And I think famously, like, I think it is Saw 6, which is regarded as one of the better sequels because it has this whole breakdown of the American healthcare system and how they're basically scamming him out of his treatment. And that's really good. And I do think that's why they are really trying to lean into that for this film, it seems like, because that's one of the better received sequels. But again, you're just bringing up old ground. I think you've already done that, and you did that so effectively with, like, say, the breakdown of the American healthcare system, whereas this seems a bit more on the nose of like, oh, he just travels to Mexico to try and do some risky, dodgy stuff, and then it turns out they're just con artists. Like, that's just not as inherently interesting on the surface. But then saying it in this time period again, like between 1 and 2, which again, I now obviously reading that, it makes perfect sense why Shawnee is back, because that's obviously very centered in the kind of Amanda, the Amanda timeline part of the story. You know, through her first game that we see in Saw 1 through flashbacks, but obviously then we see her, like, her police interview, and then obviously her being in the game in Saw 2 and the reveal, the amazing reveal that she's working with Jigsaw at this point. But yeah, I just don't see how that's going to transpire because, you know, Tobin Bell can kind of get away with it, but Shawnee Smith is going to look so different to how she looked in Saw 1 and Saw 2 now. I just don't think it's going to work. This is a weird one. Like, and I totally get why they're doing this as well, because what I like is that this is a lot more simple. This seems like a way less bullshit than the recent ones. This is clearly them trying to appease the fans and be like, okay, what are the fans like? They like Tobin Bell. They like Shawnee Smith. Let's just get it back to that. And it's probably not going to have, hopefully, some new reveal of a bloody, you know, new killer or something like that.
God, I hope they do.
But it's just weird, isn't it? Because I think at this point, Listen, we'll see the trailer, and obviously we'll have more in-depth thoughts then, because it, you know, it could look great or whatever. But it's just difficult at this point when you've gone back to the well so many times. This really is like the modern day version of what you used to get. Really, what's funny in like classic horror franchises, where you would just continue to milk it, and you continue to milk it, and it didn't matter how many bad installment after bad installment, as long as there was people still relatively gave a shit about it, you could just keep churning this out. And that's exactly where we're at with Saw right now, because we could potentially be seeing the fourth bad Saw movie in a row, and like, that's just crazy after starting with six bangers in a row. But yeah, do you have anything else to add on this one, or should we wait until the trailer?
I mean, I think it's just that I find it fascinating that, you know, like something like Star Wars, when people are like, oh man, they transfix on like that gap between episode 2 and 3, and they put so much content between that, and I'm like, man, Saw is just a whole nother level, where like we have movies that are like the 8-hour gap between like one of the scenes in the previous movie, and they turn that into an entire like, you know, 90-minute film, and I'm just like, I'd love to see the timeline and how these movies go backwards and forwards. It would just be insane. Yeah. You know, and you're right. They probably are doing the best they could try to do to appease the fans, because we do just want these characters alive and doing what they do best. And when they died in the third installment, they, you know, it's always been problematic for the franchise. And they did as much as they could going forwards with it still kind of having those people in and still and you know and being good, and then they kind of went, well, we can't possibly have them in it anymore because they've been dead for so long, so what the hell do we do now? Let's create a load of new killers. That didn't work. Okay, let's just get them playing those roles in a timeline where they're still alive in this world. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess if I have to have something, that's what I would want the most, I guess.
Yeah,
what would I want, you know, at this point? You know, yeah. I just don't really want a Saw movie is the honest answer.
No, I don't either. I think what I would want is for them to step away, not make a Saw movie for at least 8 years, and then give it to a creative new mind who's got a new take on it. And it would be a reimagining, you know, where it would be potentially about a guy with cancer who, you know, has that same backstory, but it's not going to have any of the same actors. It's not going to be a legacy sequel or any of that bullshit. Like, it's just going to be a fresh start. And like I say, let someone be creative with it and see what they can come up with. But it's, horror is very, very rarely does that. Like, what I'm describing in my head, I'm even struggling to think of what the example of it would be, where it happens with individual movies. I'm thinking of like Dawn of the Dead is a good example, right? I think Dawn of the Dead, the, you know, 2004 or whatever, Zack Snyder's one, has the same essence of the original, but is a completely different take on it.
And there's one
that's different because it's just one film, isn't it, rather than a franchise.
Yeah, and I just think, like, you know, the remakes have become such a dirty word.
Yeah.
That they just don't want them. You know, you look at Evil Dead Rise that we've seen this year, and it's like, well, they wanted to call that anything but a remake. You know, and it's not a remake, but you know, why be afraid of just putting that film out there and just be like, yeah, we're just retelling the story in a different way, you know? But it's like, no, they have to kind of somehow, you know, crowbar it in, and yeah, and they just want them to be these sequel reimagining, you know. And it's like Scream just hit the nail on the head with it when they talk about it, and it's just, you know, it is infuriating that that's where we're at. We're actually just like, if we have to keep these franchises alive, the reboot or the remakes were actually like a decent tool for doing that for some of these.
Yeah, and like I say, especially if you lean towards trying to make it different, because I think that's what's way
better. You know, Candyman.
Yeah, Candyman, exactly. Like, I think it's, even Evil Dead Rise, like, I kind of like that on paper, you know, where it is just kind of taking elements of what Evil Dead is doing its own thing.
I think it was more that, like, Candyman's not a great example, but, like, with Evil Dead, like, they were really trying not to say that they wanted to try to make it fit in that world and not use the reimagining branding so much. And I think that's the bit where, yeah, like, I think I like what they tried to do, which is, yeah, it is exactly a reimagining, you know, just like the Fede one was as well, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think another example as well is the Child's Play film. I think that's another great example of, like, it doesn't, you know, it takes the essence of what that original movie is, but when you actually get it, it's so different. And I think that's why I never think about that movie and ever compare it to the original Child's Play. And we said before, like, it's annoying that there's these two films with the same titles because they're so dramatically different. And I like them both for completely different reasons. And that's what I would love to get with Saw. I think there's so much in Saw, and strip it back to what it was originally, which was, you know, heavily inspired by Seven and, like, a lot more of a gritty thriller, rather than the sort of, you know, blood fest that it became in the sequels. It would be interesting for sure. But we'll definitely have more to say on Saw, as always. But next up is probably not something we'll have as much to speak about, because it certainly is not a franchise that speaks to either of us, sadly. But there's a new trailer out for a movie that I'd almost forgotten was coming out this year. But it's certainly going to be one of the most talked about horror movies of the year, which is the new Exorcist movie, titled The Exorcist Believer, which is a really bad title. This is really coming out. Yeah, well, you've got to fit it into that trilogy mold, which we'll get to. But this is coming out around Halloween, so this is the big movie that I'm sure Saw just shit itself over and ran away from. We got the first trailer, pretty lengthy trailer for this one. And as I kind of just joked about, this is part of a new trilogy. For people that don't know anything about this, this is the exact same kind of mold as what they did with Halloween recently, almost to a T. So it's going to be a trilogy. It's a legacy sequel, which is kind of bringing in the original. We've got a returning cast member as well from that original film. And I'm assuming throwing out the other sequels other than just the original. With a trilogy coming, I think, every other year. And of course, it has to be directed by David Gordon Green at this point as well. So it's ticking all the boxes of those recent Halloween movies, which we've spoke to death. I think what's way more interesting of a conversation here is that I don't like The Exorcist. I'm very outspoken about that. That in terms of the all-time classic horror movies, if I had to pick one that's my least favorite, it's absolutely The Exorcist. Just never, ever, ever jive with me at any level from early age to now. I've never liked any of those films. What about you? Are you? I guess you're similar, but probably not as aggressively against The Exorcist. Like, you don't really like it, do you, either?
No, like, it certainly... I don't dislike the movie. I haven't really seen it that much. It's just one that I'm, you know... Back when these ghost and possession things were infrequent, I didn't seek them out. You know, The Omen was probably the one out of all of them that I watched the most and was more... you know, a fan of, and all of the other ones that people talk about, I haven't really seen, and that's The Exorcist included within that.
Yeah, so I feel like we're coming more from a, you know, I want to just view this movie on its own, because, yeah, I couldn't tell you much about, like, I had to look up who this cast member was that was returning, like, that's my level of understanding of this franchise. And being like, oh, it was the, because I was like, it was not Reagan. Like, that's, you know, I know it wasn't Linda Blair. And that's about my knowledge of The Exorcist. But then I looked it up and I was like, oh, it's her mum from the original movie is kind of the woman that we see in this trailer. Did you see this trailer?
Yeah, and I wouldn't have known that was her, and apart from the screenshot they give us to tell us.
Yeah, which, to be fair, I read that before, but I think having just watched the trailer, I think it does a good job of explaining it. Like, I think I would have got that.
I was going to say, I was like, oh, okay, it's her mum, like, from the trailer.
Yeah, which is good. But yeah, what did you make of this trailer?
Yeah, like, I didn't mind the trailer. Like, I kind of watched it and was like, do you know what? Like, as I was watching it, I was like... I can get my head around and like these exorcism movies way more than these other haunting movies that are out there. You know, I think having this person that's possessed, that's doing these things, it can have some good scares. It can have some good moments. You know, I quite like the whole vibe of them going missing and then kind of, you know, being found and all of that stuff. I quite liked when it started to get more into them just being possessed. I was less into the trailer, but I kind of, you know, in the last few weeks, we have seen so many of these movies, trailers for these movies. And it just feels like the next 4 or 5 months is just nothing but these sorts of movies. And this was one where I'm like, I'm not against this one, like, in comparison to so many of the others that we've seen.
Yeah, I actually completely agree. I think out of all the trailers that we've seen, which includes The Nun 2 and A Haunting in Venice and plenty of other ones that I've even forgot already. This was easily the best trailer. I think it starts so strong. Like, I love the setup with these two girls that just go off to school and they go missing. And it felt so real and brutal, them showing, like, the parents pleading on the news and stuff. Where I was, like, I was really in straight away. And then kind of, you know, they show them arrive back and clearly something's happened to them. And then I agree with you that once we get into just like the possession stuff, I don't know about it because it wasn't that good. But I can't tell if that's just the trailer trying to make, you know, long drawn out creepy scenes feel like very fun and fantastical for a trailer. And a lot of, I feel like the smash cuts and kind of the, you know, eccentricity of modern day trailers doesn't bode well for a film like this. But maybe I'm just giving the film too much credit. But yeah, like the second half of the trailer wasn't as good. But I definitely walked away with this, again, as someone who doesn't like The Exorcist and obviously does not like this director. Like, I thought this looked decent. And I thought it looked way better than I expected. You know, when we talked about this in the news and stuff, I was like, I don't even know if I want to see this because I don't want to just sit there and be bitching about how much I don't like The Exorcist or this director for the whole episode. Whereas I feel like this trailer did enough to be like, no, I think I can put that to one side and just view this as a film because I think it looked cool. There was some real creepy stuff in there. And I just love the concept of it being this duo of like best friends that are both possessed. I think that's such a good hook.
I think that's the element, the fact that there's this duo as well, you know, that it does feel like a fresh element that we've not just got one young girl that's possessed, you know, having these two that you know, we can have two different, you know, families experiencing it, and then they can be together, and there's just a lot more dynamic that you can do with it, which I like.
Mm.
I did find, because The Exorcist music is great. Like,
oh yeah, I forgot about that.
my God, it was awful in the trailer. Like the little couple of seconds of it, like building up to it, and then the way that then when they played it for the first time, they felt like it was like we had normally you get this in the movie, you know, that's what we got in Halloween, where it was like, oh, we're gonna get like little teasers of the music and then it's gonna hit at a moment. This happened in the fucking trailer. I was like, that's a whole new level of I don't even know what, but I was not a fan.
Yeah, you're so good at reminding me of the worst parts of these things, because that absolutely, like, that was the part of the trailer where I went, oh, it's the guy who made Halloween doing this, because that was, like, unbelievable, where I think that is one of the best, if not the best horror theme ever. It's so fucking good, but I can't believe by the end of a 3-minute trailer, it made me not want to hear it. Where I was like, how have you, and that's exactly what those Halloween movies did, where it's the Halloween music's the best part about Halloween, and they just continually hit you over the head with so many different versions of it that I just hated it by the end of those films. And yeah, I couldn't believe how much that annoyed me, and I had blocked that from my memory until this moment. But yeah, again, hopefully that's just a bad trailer choice, but like, I'm completely with you, and based upon what they did with that iconic theme in the last films, I think it's going to be exactly the same, is that you're going to constantly hear those first three bars of The Exorcist for the first hour and a half of that film. Like, and then you'll finally hit it at the end. So yeah, that was annoying. But yeah, I'm definitely more positive on this than I was expecting, which is surprising given a multitude of reasons, but certainly the fact that I just don't enjoy many trailers. And this was one that I was like, oh yeah, this has made me like this more, which is the entire intent of every trailer. But just has the opposite, you know, the adverse effect on me, because I just hate spoilers so much. But yeah, good bit of horror news there. I'm sure we'll be talking about both those films for a while. But shall we talk about not a horror film?
Yeah, why not?
Let's talk about Oppenheimer. So yeah, like we said at the start, just having a bit of fun this week. Allow us that. this is our holiday away from horror. Checking out the new Christopher Nolan movie on the IMAX screen, which is always a joy seeing it back-to-back weeks. Obviously, we got to see Mission Impossible on that gorgeous screen last week. Now we got to see a very different film, in fact, in every single way. But yeah, where do you even want to start with this one?
I don't know.
would you like me to do a plot synopsis for a change?
Do you want to?
I can do, yeah. I feel like I got it.
All right, go on.
So, yeah, for people that don't know anything about this movie, and I'm sure it's difficult because it's like, how do you even explain who Oppenheimer is if you don't know? But essentially, this movie is a biopic, like so many of the recent famous ones, like Elvis, etc.
There was once a war.
Yes, there was, yeah. Oh, yeah. How, like, granular do you want to go? So there was this Austrian painter. No, we're not going that granular. But yeah, essentially, this is the most recent of these, named biopics. Oppenheimer, J. Robert Oppenheimer, who's kind of well known as the father of the atomic bomb. Obviously, he's a legendary name, physicist who, was part of the development of the first nuclear weapons in America specifically. This movie is based upon a book called American Prometheus, which kind of details his whole life and death and is just his entire story, which is what this movie tries to do in a lean 3 hours, which, we'll get to the runtime. I don't think it feels like a 3 hour long movie. I think a lot of it feels rushed at times, which is crazy. But I think it's just the kind of story of what and the life that this man lived that it easily could have been like a 15-hour Netflix docuseries that still wouldn't have covered everything. And also, this film jumps around in time a lot. But we essentially start with him kind of in his earlier years. Him studying, he goes to Europe to study physics, to learn new ideas, and then eventually takes them back to America. During the course of this, this kind of World War II breaks out, and the American government are obviously trying to fight the Nazis. And he is tasked with kind of heading this major project of, building the first nuclear weapons, because that's what the Nazis are going to try and do. So again, we're jumping around time a lot, but that's the breadth of the kind of timeline. We also see a lot of, I guess, flash forward in time to a sort of deposition on Oppenheimer, everything that they did in this little kind of startup town called Los Alamos, which we'll get to. But that's essentially where the Manhattan Project took place when they were making and developing these nuclear weapons. It's a deposition on whether or not Oppenheimer can still have his security clearance. He's been accused of a lot of sort of political crimes, his ties to communist Russia at the time. As well as this other character, Lewis Strauss, who's kind of played by Robert Downey Jr. as like his arch nemesis in the film. There's a lot of different threads. So I feel like that's the overall kind of gist of this film. It is the life story of Oppenheimer, but it's generally centered around his time in the Manhattan Project, juxtapositioned with this deposition later on in life and kind of his his political downfall, as it were. Anything else you want to touch upon? Obviously, there's a lot of characters that we haven't gone into. For example, Kitty, and what was Florence's character? Is it Lola? No, what is it? Jean Tatlock. But yeah, there's plenty of other characters to get into, but I feel like that's sort of the gist, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, like, names and faces that, like, firstly, famous faces and people that you know, names and faces, but also then the characters that they play, there's so many callbacks to them. But yeah, I mean, this is, on paper, this is a 3 hour movie where there's very little action and it's mostly just talking and discussion about quite high level science and quite high level espionage and political warfare and a lot of that. And if you describe that to me, I'm like, well, I'm giving this one a miss then. But this is the most fast paced 3 hour talking movie I've ever seen in my life, where I never felt bored, and I always felt like, can we just slow down and talk a bit longer, please? Which is such a bizarre thing. Like, I've never had a feeling about a movie like this before where I'm like, I think talking about Mission Impossible is a great like juxtaposition of it, where like that was a 2 hour 40 movie that was over 2 hours of pure action, where it went in a blink of an eye. Whereas, like, for this to go as quickly as it did, to really have nothing in the way of cinematic action, you know, there's obviously the test of the bomb, which is a big moment in the film. And other than that, the real kind of cinematic kind of experience is these little moments in Oppenheimer's head when he has these, like, it's almost like the vision's clearing and he's like sparks flying and you kind of see it, like what is going on in his head in like this image. And other than that, like it's just pure conversation and pure setup, but it's truly fascinating. You know, I think the movie, obviously, you know, being Nolan and being, you know, the level of filmmaking that he can produce, it shouldn't just be said like that, but you know, you kind of take it for granted that the movie's going to look and be as good as it is all round. But then the cast that you've got in it, you know, Cillian Murphy is just exquisite in this, you know, and seeing Robert Downey Jr. in the kind of role as you know, his arch nemesis, you know, he was absolutely fantastic. All of the cast, you know, like you say, when we get Kitty with Emily Blunt, you know, she's fantastic. Just everyone, Matt Damon was knocked out of the park. Just every one of these people just played it to perfection. And I think that's what makes this movie stand out, that just everyone's in their A game. And it really does feel like, you know, I think we've had it with, like, or at least we've felt it with Tarantino for years, where he'll get these people and he'll get, like, you know, Brad Pitt and Inglourious Basterds just doing this, like, just like, knocking it out of the park, because you know he's having the time of his life with a director that he's just having a great time with. And I think that's exactly what we're getting with Nolan at this point, that these people are just having a great time and he's letting them have this great time, and it makes the movie stronger. I think as well, like, just Cillian Murphy is, like, obviously we've spoken about him recently in our rewatch of Red Eye, but I'm so glad, like, he's back on our big screens, because even as someone that watched Peaky Blinders, and I think, like, he's great in it, and it was iconic when the first few seasons came out, but that show really overstayed its welcome and ran its course, and it's probably still not over. It's probably going to get on our big screens, but I'm just glad that he's not just tethered to that, because I feel like I've not seen him, like, in recent years outside of that in much at all. So, like, I'm pleased after seeing this to remind me that, you know, I guess, you know, probably, you know, we got what, Quiet Place, and he was in Dunkirk as well, weren't he, a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, but, like, I can't remember that much in recent years that he was in. So, yeah, like, just seeing him in this reminded me, like, how much I love him on the big screen as this, you know, just absolute world-class actor. And so, yeah, it's a weird one where it's, like, it's hard to unpack, like, as a movie to discuss for the podcast, because it is just 3 hours of talking, you know.
Yeah,
there isn't a particular scene that I want to kind of draw on and moment within the film. Like, you know, obviously the test of the bomb I thought was really, you know, was a great, you know, just combination of everything. But obviously, what, you know, this movie knows that it knows that people are going to be watching it knowing nothing. It knows that people will be going into this movie watching, knowing everything, and it knows that people will be going into it knowing some of what happened. You know, I knew a bomb got made, and I knew that it caused a lot of problems. You know, it killed a lot of people. So when they're doing the test and they're like, "Oh, does the world end?" I'm like, "Well, no, the world doesn't end." Like, I know this, and you know, I think most, you know, so they're amping up tension, but to something that we know, you know, it's very true to the history, or feels very true. Like, everything I saw in it was stuff that, you know, tallied with what I knew. I don't know how much embellishment was done in certain areas, but I think when you've got something like that, it's hard to really try to create this tension and everything else. And so the movie doesn't, it just tells the story. It's like, no, this is just a really fascinating story and a story that should be told. So we're just going to focus on that. And we're not going to have all these twists and turns and, you know, bring people into it. Because I think, like, something like, you know, Hitler and the Germans and stuff, it's touched upon. But obviously, this isn't the part of war that really is to do with them. You know, Nazi Germany is defeated by the time the bomb is live, you know, so he's not a huge part of the movie. You know, I think the only real surprise for me in the movie was the Einstein stuff. I didn't think they'd have as much or mm-hmm. any of that. Like, I was surprised when he popped up. I didn't really know of their kind of relationship or was expecting him to be in multiple scenes, quite pivotal scenes of the movie mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that aside, I mean, it was fantastic, but it's one that, like, I just don't remember seeing a movie like this where I just feel so strange about it, where I'm like, it was great. And people are like, why? And I'm like, it was just great. Like, I just like seeing people talk.
Yeah, it's so weird, because I do think I agree with you that, like, on paper, this just shouldn't work as well as, like, not that it shouldn't work, but as well as it does, because I think this over delivers on everything. Where I think if you're telling a 3-hour story about, you know, this physicist and kind of his history and what he did, like you rightly said, what most filmmakers would try and do would be to either over embellish stuff or bring in other parts of the story to kind of make it more sexy and have the Nazis play more of a role. Or, you know, like, I couldn't believe there wasn't like a car chase in this film where yeah. I was like, he's got to find a way of getting a car chase in it. Like he just won't be able to help himself. And it's like, no, it's like this conversation took place in a boardroom. So that's how it's going to be portrayed in this film. But we're going to make it as exciting as a car chase because the level of production, the way it's shot, the score in the background, but then the level of the acting, which is across the board, almost like unlike anything I've really seen before. Because I think as we discuss time and time again, like, we see bad horror films this year where we're like, the acting was good. And I think with that, and as I rightly say in those episodes, that's the level we're at now. Where we can see shit horror films that have, like, noteworthy performances. Because we're just so blessed in that category across the board in film that the acting in general has never been better than the year, you know, 2023. Like, it's just unbelievable how many good actors there are across the board. From the absolute A-list and A-level performance like this to very low-level indie films, you know, that you'll see at a Fright Fest. You will get amazing performances in even those smaller films. But then to be reminded of the absolute A-class, which this film is, it really reminded me of, like, what The Last of Us was for TV. I feel like this film is for film, which is that you have probably 8 actors that you could do a whole podcast on discussing the nuances of their performance. But I have to start with Killian, because he blew me away. Like, I feel like we've been so lucky to see, you know, his career unfold in front of our eyes. And it feels so weird that he was that guy in 28 Days Later, you know, that woke up in the film. Yeah, like, that was 20 years ago. And now he's the lead in a way that, like, is unbelievable. Like, I don't think there's ever been a Nolan lead like this. Because he's literally in almost every scene. You know, when he's not in it, they're constantly saying the character's name. Like, he's everything. And I think this movie doesn't work without the perfect Oppenheimer. And I think Killian, his performance is what I think makes the movie so easy to watch, is he goes on such an unbelievable range of emotions. And I think that's where the actual horror of this worked so well, is that they don't show you stuff. You know, which is another point which we'll get to in terms of, like, they don't show you Hiroshima and Nagasaki getting bombed or anything like that. But I think you feel such pain and exhaustion and all of these emotions purely through, like, mostly just Killian's facial expressions is mostly how it's portrayed. Like, again, as you said earlier, we get these moments when we go right into the mind of Oppenheimer, and we get some visuals to accompany it, usually just use of light, but it's mostly through sound. And then it's just the sounds of what he's seeing with just his facial reactions. And, like, those scenes are harrowing in a way that is, like, unbelievable given how little you actually see. Where I think a lot of people, if you're not thinking about it too hard, will think they saw stuff. because they'll misremember it. They'll go, oh yeah, I couldn't believe they showed you the devastated streets after the bombing. And it's like, no, they didn't. They showed you, you know, on Killian's face, Oppenheimer's reaction and what he was going through mentally, and through the use of, again, amazing sound, which I think is the main reason to see this movie in IMAX, is for that sound. But his performance just carries it so well and sells it. He sells this whole film, where I think there's a lot to talk about here that is great, of course, but I think if you had a even like a B-plus performance or something around that area, this film wouldn't have felt as special. And that'll be my biggest takeaway, is there's so many things to love about this film, but it'll remind me, like, this is... People have already spoke about whether this is, you know, Christopher Nolan's best movie and will it be remembered as his most notable movie and stuff like that, which I think is very difficult to say in the moment. But what I feel 100% safe on saying is that this is absolutely Cillian Murphy's, you know, moment to shine. This is his masterpiece. And I would love to see him outdo himself in the future, but I think it's just one of those things where it all came together. He has the right look. He's the right age profile. He's the right everything, let alone just then his level of acting talent is so remarkable in this film. I think the acting is easily like the standout. I think when he has a sparring partner is probably my favorite scenes of the film. For me, most notably, it would be Matt Damon, the back and forth with his character, and then the Jason Clarke character, who's kind of like the lead sort of prosecutor in one of the deposition sequences we see a lot. I think those scenes are when you really, again, Killian's facial expressions alone are amazing, but I love when he's going back and forth with someone and he's really getting to dive deep into the character. He's being questioned about all of his motives, and I love that he's portrayed as such a flawed character as well. Like, they keep putting it out there where it's like, well, you did this, but now you're saying this, why is that? And like him trying to comprehend with his own miscomings and being like, yeah, I know what I did, and I know I feel shitty for it, and there's nothing I can do about it. I think he's such a He's a fascinating person. That was like my biggest takeaway from this entire film, really, was like, I want to learn so much about Oppenheimer, even though we already did from this film. But again, like, in terms of the morality of what he done, which is what I think is the entire crux of this film, is dealing with, you've created the weapon that could end the world. It hasn't, but it doesn't mean it won't. And I think that's what's so fascinating about this whole film, is like, in those moments, those were the things that really got me. And like you mentioned it, where there were scenes when they would talk about the potential ramifications of what he was building and how obviously that's not what happened. But my takeaway was kind of like, I feel like I was watching a film that explained how the world ended.
Yeah.
And it's like, but it just hasn't happened yet.
Well, that's like, that's kind of the stalemate that we've been in. You know, which is incredible. And I think as well, it just, they really play into the morality of that decision that he had to make, where it was like, do I make it and have it in the hands of the side I'm on, or do I let the other side get it with their scientists? Who's going to get it first? And when we do get it first, then how many people are we going to kill? And he, you know, the way he disassociated himself away from it, where he was like, I'm making this weapon because I need to, and I'm not the one that's gonna fire it. You know, it's not, the blood isn't on my hands. And I think it was when Jason Clarke's character is really probing him and saying, well, you were in the room when they had the 10 cities and you helped pick that city. Like, you weren't disassociated from it. You were pivotal in that fucking decision making process. Like, don't pretend you didn't. And then, like, just the look on Killian's face when it was just like the gravitas that, yeah, these, you know, hundreds and thousands of people that were killed and affected by it were directly, you know, the blood is on your hands, you know, really. Mm-hmm. You are the father of this. Your face is on Time magazine. You know, you can't be the face of Time magazine and not have the blood on your hands as well. And I think, like, those were the thoughts that kept with me when I left the cinema, was the kind of the weight and the kind of, in particular, not I mean, I don't think you can really put spoilers up, because this is just history that spoiling World War II, do you know what I mean? But like when we get to the final image of this movie and we see kind of him almost in celebration of it, and it's kind of gone full circle, and it's like, you know, how does a man like that feel? And I think on a daily basis he feels different, because does he walk around America thinking, I kept this on, every, you know, kept this going, people are alive on in this country because of what I did, these families had their husbands and fathers come home, you know, and a bomb didn't land on our home shores and kill hundreds of thousands of people, like I did that? Or does he look on the other side and look at the hundreds of thousands of people that he did kill directly with the weapon he made? You know, the how an individual weighs that in their mind just blows my mind. And I think it was the reason why I talk about it so much, because it's not, we're not talking about the movie here, is that that is so well represented in Killian's performance. And like you said, I think it really does come to the forefront when he is being pushed by someone.
I think that is the movie, though. I think that's what, like you say, that is, it's purely about the morality of it, and kind of what, again, the reason why you don't show the bombs, for example, going off is because this entire story is told from the perspective of Oppenheimer. So, you know, he wasn't there. And I think they portray that in such an awesome way when they finally do finish the testing, which is kind of the most extensive use that we see of the bomb, because obviously that was Oppenheimer's first-hand impression. But then the moment it's complete, that conversation he has with Matt Damon's character is amazing. You know, where he's just kind of asking him questions about, so when's the, is the president going to use it? Where is he going to use it? Oh, can you take me to the Pentagon so I can be part of those discussions? And the kind of look, and again, an amazing performance from Matt Damon, where he's just like, you, surely you're not this deluded. Like, you're asking me questions that you're a smart person. You know the answer to this. Like, you know your role in this is now finished.
Yeah, you know you're done.
Yeah, you have no say in any of this. It's like, you were just the guy that we needed to get us to the next stage. And now this is over. The second we see that bomb driven away on the back of the truck, it's the last time we ever see it. And it's because it's the last time Oppenheimer ever saw it. You know, and once it's out of his hands, that's it. And then he obviously has to deal with the morality that he helped build something that was used against people. But I loved that. Like, that's what, well, that's what this entire film, I think, was about. And it's about getting into the politics of it all, which again is something that I usually wouldn't care about, but the kind of the use of American politics, how he kind of had these sort of communist ideas when he was younger that he kind of grew out of, that were always used against him, the fact that when he was when he first got into it, I think it was Roosevelt was the president that they mention, that we don't see,
he spanned multiple, you know, presidents.
Yeah, so like Roosevelt was one who he clearly liked politically, and then throughout the bulk of the movie it's Truman who we do eventually see, who is someone who he doesn't like politically, and so that's a really interesting thing as well, of like, you know, he's trying to serve his country, but he does have very different political views to different presidents. And I think, again, that's something that they get across so well, is the fact that, yeah, he wants to, he keeps trying to position it like he's doing it for the good, like he's also just doing it as a scientist, because I think that's another thing that's super interesting when you're dealing with his profession, is that like scientists deal in actualities, they don't necessarily need to or should deal in morality choices, and what's right or wrong, they just have to deal in absolutes. So when they say, can you split the atom, the answer is yes or no, the answer isn't should you split the atom, and I think
they don't deal in consequence, they deal in fact, and then, you know, and theory, and then the realization of that theory, you know,
that gets handed over to someone else,
not the consequence.
That's not your call to decide what to do with this information. And I think that's what's so, again, fascinating about this very specific period of human history, which is obviously under this kind of war, which is super fascinating anyway, an actual world war, and this kind of race where the Nazis clearly have a lead, but they're clearly making mistakes where they don't want to trust these Jewish scientists. So that's why they're able to like recruit a lot of the world's best scientists to this location to give America the upper edge at this time. And like you said, it's funny how it ultimately was something that they thought was going to play a big part in the war, but then didn't, because like they mentioned in the film, by the time the testing was complete, Hitler had already blown his brains out in a bunker, so it, and then, you know, obviously it gets used on the Japanese. So like, it's, there's so much in here that I find fascinating. I think, like, the story is unbelievable, and that's why I mentioned that it's 3 hours. I didn't look at the time once, and I feel like it flew past. The pace of this is unreal. When we're talking about just conversations of people talking, a lot of the times it will be like, and so here, you know, Oppenheimer went to Cambridge to study, and it'll be like a 10-second interaction, and then suddenly he's somewhere else, and then suddenly he's somewhere else, and like immediately, I don't know about you, but like within 5 minutes of this film starting, I kind of leant forward in my chair and was like, right, this is one of those movies. Like, I need to pay attention. I can't blink. I need to be thinking and remembering all of these names and locations, because if I let my mind wander for like a couple of scenes, I'm going to just lose track of this completely.
Definitely. I had to get my pipe out and like put my little thinking cap on and was ready to go.
Yeah.
I think as well, I think probably the best scene, you know, of the movie for me really was when the bomb does hit, and it's just the un-anticlimactic kind of way that they're just all chilling, and then they just hear it on the radio like everyone else. Like, they just hear that news, and to see the reaction, because, you know, it's like these people worked for years to achieve this. So there's people that are celebrating like crazy, and then there's people that are vomiting in the streets because they know they've just like almost committed genocide, you know. And it's like, you know, but then other people are celebrating because they have actually stopped genocide of their race. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's just like this weird, like, you know, this whole scene of this town of like people reacting in different ways, and like all of the reactions are just, you know, for what they're going through. And I just thought it was so well done, with obviously the camera being primarily focused on Killian, who's going through, or Oppenheimer, who's going through all of these emotions on screen at the same time as all of these other characters.
And it
was just, you know, and I think like that, it's just the understate, you know, it really was just like, you know, an artist that's got all the colors in the world in his palette, but he's like, no, I'm just going to pick these half a dozen. Like, I don't need that car chase. Like, I know I can do a car chase, but there's no car chase. Like, yeah, I could blow up a plane. There's no blown up planes. Like, no, chill.
Yeah, like, it's fascinating, you know, he made this after Tenet, because I think Tenet was like, you know, it's him doing a brand new original IP.
Him doing every color.
Yeah, exactly. That was the most Nolan thing of like, I'm going to do sci-fi. I'm going to do time travel. I'm going to do all of this batshit crazy shit that doesn't make any goddamn sense. And I feel like he, you know, it's interesting with Tenet, because I've seen it twice, and I really enjoyed it the first time at the cinema, and I really did not like it when I watched it at home. Thought it was probably his worst film. And so I kind of have a mixed reaction where I don't know how I feel about it now, because I've seen it twice and had two very different reads on it.
You need the rubber, man.
Yeah, I just, oh God, it's so, I don't want to have to bring up the boring Tenet conversation again, but like the sound design in that movie is fucking terrible. And that was the thing I was most worried about going into this film. Because it started with Dark Knight Rises, which I didn't have a problem with, because I thought it suited the Bane character to not fully understand what he was saying. But I got the frustrations. Tenet, it made no sense whatsoever, whereas like you just couldn't hear what people were saying because the sound design was terrible. And then this film, I could see people criticizing for, because there are times when the background score is like unbelievably loud in the IMAX. But for me, it worked perfectly, because I feel like it always came in at times when you weren't necessarily needing to hear every word. I think with Tenet, I was losing specific plot points, and because I was struggling to follow the plot so hardly. Whereas with this, it would be like, yeah, you're in the middle of a deposition, and obviously, and then it's like Oppenheimer's kind of zoning out, you know, and he's thinking about the ramifications, and that's when the score comes in. So I don't need to hear what every person in that room is saying at that time.
No.
Did that make sense to you? Kind of, is that how you read it? And did you realize how just kind of like, I love the sound in general, but at times it is mind-numbingly loud, which I think works awesome for this film, but I could see how people would be turned off by it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a point where I'm like, because the IMAX as well is just so fucking bad. There were a couple of times where I was like, this is too much. Like, because again, like, you know, when you watch Mission Impossible, you've got 2 hours of carnage.
Yeah.
So it's always louder than your face. So you kind of get used to that volume. But just at times where it's like, there are a couple that hit me like a jump scare in a horror movie.
Yeah, they are like jump scares. Yeah.
because it's just like it's so quiet, and then it's just like this crazy loud noise. But it didn't piss me off, but I did feel at times it did go too far. But it didn't get to the point that the sound got in the way of the dialogue, which is incredibly important when this movie, you know, is as strong as it is. The only last thing I did, you know, I've touched upon it a little bit, but I really, you know, Matt Damon was phenomenal in this as well.
So good.
Like, I think
there's two guaranteed Oscar noms here. And I think Killian as lead and Matt as supporting has to be there.
Definitely, because I think with, you know, with Killian and with Oppenheimer, like the setup and everything was great to learn about him, but it was the second Matt Damon appeared that that's when the movie got to another level for me. That was when I was like, oh, it's amping up, the war's on, we're getting that. And it's just this level of recruitment and manipulation where it's like, was he the best man for the job? I don't know whether he was, Oppenheimer, but he was the one that they could manipulate best and be the pawn the best because of everything that they knew about him. And they already saw the writing on the wall. Like, day one, they knew, oh, okay, he can be our fool guy as well. Yeah. Not only can he create this, we can blame him for this when the time is right. And I loved it. I, like, obviously, you know, that's not Nolan. That's not anyone else. It is them giving me that, but the story exists in the world already. But their execution was, you know, just absolutely exquisite. And yeah, Matt Damon was phenomenal in this.
Oh yeah, like I say, it's absolutely both. Where, like, I'm sure this book is fascinating, but to get that across in a 3-hour epic is something that I think only Christopher Nolan could do. Like, I think that's what's so crazy about this, and why I think people will talk about it as being his best film, where I prefer when he's making stuff like Inception and Interstellar. For me, they're like untouchable, but I love what he was able to achieve here, because I don't think anyone else could have made what this film is as entertaining and interesting as Christopher Nolan did, where I think he lets the characters breathe at times, but then he also can add in, you know, his great sound and his great just like cinematic vision. You know, he's one of those people that, you know, like an Edgar Wright, who is like pined over every frame, and he's thinking about how does it look on the screen that we saw it on. You know, like, that's the way to see this film, where this isn't a traditional blockbuster like Mission Impossible is. It's, you know, like I say, it's mostly people talking in rooms. But, like, I felt like it was worthy to see on the big screen. I feel like I needed to. It, also, the way it's shot with the IMAX is a lot of close-ups, which, again, only factors into the fact of if you've got an IMAX camera an inch away from an actor's face, it's showing everything. Like, a micro movement on their cheek is going to come across on the screen. So you are kind of screwing over your actors in the sense of there is nowhere to hide in this film. Like, if they do one single beat that's out of character, you will see it. And there isn't in 3 hours, because everyone is so exceptionally well directed and obviously incredibly, you know, acted, that it just works. There was one element of this movie that I'm kind of torn on, and I don't know how I feel about it, and it might be one of the only negatives, and I'm really curious about your take on it. And it's someone who's definitely worth talking about, especially because of her history in horror films. Florence Pugh in this film, and her character of Jean Tatlock. It's a fascinating part of the film, again, not necessarily for good reasons for me, and I'm struggling to even verbalize what my issue with it was, but I found it to be slightly jarring with the rest of the film. Almost, again, maybe this needed more time, but when they first met, it was almost like laughable how quickly things like transpired. Like, he meets her and within like 10 seconds they're having sex.
It felt like a James Bond movie.
Yeah, like, but a James Bond movie that went, we're just going to show you all of the sex as well. And so that was really jarring, first of all, how you've got a movie with a lot of spinning plates to get through, but they're jumping you in with this relationship. They're showing the sex really full on. And with it being these major actors as well, like, I found it really jarring, especially from Florence, where this felt more like something that you would see as a breakout performance, you know, like Margot Robbie in The Wolf of Wall Street. Like, she's not doing that now. And it was weird to me to be like, Florence Pugh is so successful and so big, and now she's doing a role which is very small in comparison to everyone else in this film. And it's mostly just sex scenes. And I don't know, I found that to be interesting and slightly jarring and a bit off-putting. I was waiting for there to be more to her character, and there sadly just wasn't. But what did you make of her? Because I feel like that what I've said might be a controversial opinion, but I didn't know. To me it didn't fit tonally with the rest of the film, I guess is the easiest way to put it.
I think you thought about it far too much, mate. I was just watching the scenes unfold and having a great time. that's what I was.
Do you think that's why Christopher put it in there? He's like, we've got something in this.
Yeah, like I don't know where you were, what you were doing. No, I'm only joking. I think you're right in that her character, I just found it strange because I think with Kitty, you really understood their relationship and their dynamic so quickly, and it wasn't explained.
Mm.
Where it wasn't this unconditional, perfect love story for them. No,
it was convenient more than anything.
But it was more than convenience as well. It was this real bond that's just not like a traditional marriage, yeah. But it's a deep bond. Like, she is with him throughout his life.
Yeah, they get that across pretty well.
And they do that so well, and it's so understated and not explained. Whereas with the Florence character, you know, when she first comes on, and they instantly get together, and then there's the whole like, don't give me flowers, and like chucking the flowers away and getting pissed off with it, but then calling him and stuff. And it was just like, I just thought to myself, like, she's just kind of annoying. And like, Killian's just, you know, or Oppenheimer should just, you know, he's better off without her. And this whole kind of like, you know, him being this womanizer and stuff, just kind of, it felt like an embellishment to the story as opposed to what actually happened. Mm. Because, you know, it's what we always joke about, that like these nerdy people make themselves like sex gods for horror movies. And it's like, yeah, this physicist that's like this, like, just crazy top level physicist was also James Bond.
Yeah,
like, I mean, I know it's Cillian Murphy, but you know, in real life, was Oppenheimer this much of a pimp?
Yeah,
and I don't know, it just felt a bit strange, that and then the fact that she was so, it, you know, the whole her not wanting, you know, her like throwing away the flowers and all of that, like, I know women are complicated, but I mean, God, she just made no sense to me, to the point where I'm like, if I was him, I'd be like, I know that's Florence Pugh, but God, this is too much. Like, fucking hell.
I feel like that's ultimately what he did, really.
Yeah.
But it was,
but far too late.
Oh, God, it was just strange. Like, I feel like this movie, regardless of who it is, which is one thing, but I feel like this movie just didn't need, like, copious sex scenes. It really felt unnecessary, and it feels like, because this movie's rated R in America, which is going to have a huge impact on who can see this movie at the box office. And so it's...
Yeah, we think it's a 15 here.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, it's... Yeah, it's for those scenes.
Definitely.
Alone.
Because the rest of the film, you know, they're talking about a lot of stuff, but they're not showing it. And so, like, it would be a, you know, 12A over here, and I'm assuming a PG-13 in America. And, like, that is a massive difference in terms of box office. And so you're giving up a lot. Then I think tonally it's weird to put sex scenes in this story about the guy who invented the atomic bomb. But then the fact that it's this megastar doing a lot of nudity for the first time as well, like, it's just, there's so much weirdness here where I want to know why she did it. I want to know why Christopher put it in the film. Like, it's, I have so, that was the only part of the story where I just had so many questions that weren't, like, you know, to do with the actual plot. It was just like, why did you make these decisions? Like, everything else was, the only questions I had were just to further the movie of like, oh, I really want to know more about the political background. And, you know, why did Strauss really have this vendetta against Oppenheimer? Was it just because he embarrassed him this one time? Like, and, you know, and let alone like the Einstein involvement. And like, there's so many fascinating character threads that I have more questions about in a positive way. And this was just the one that left me a bit like, that was weird. And I have read a bit about Jean because I wanted to know more about her as a character. And there is some interesting stuff in there that they maybe could have spent more time on. Because, you know, this is a mild spoiler, but like, the character's death is one that is kind of, basically, there is a lot of people that think she was killed, that she didn't kill herself.
Right.
And that is portrayed in the movie with like one shot of we see like a gloved hand pushing her head in the water, which is kind of, at that point, it's difficult to tell what's real and what's fake, because we keep, again, as we keep mentioning, we keep going into Oppenheimer's mind and he sees a lot of visions. So I think they do such a good job of kind of putting that theory in there, not leaning one way or the other. And then you could just be like, oh, did that actually happen? Or is that what Oppenheimer's thinking happened? So I think there's some, the way her character ends has some stuff, but yeah, she needed more. We needed more, I think, more screen time, if anything.
I just love, I mean, I could have done with more of those scenes. Like, I just love the fact that you're sat there during those scenes with these thoughts in your head. Like, what made Florence do this? Like, what was Nolan's choice of having this sex scene?
I really was. I couldn't enjoy it. I'll have to just look at those scenes in a bubble, and I'm sure I'll find some enjoyment in them. But yeah, it was just strange to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think there probably should be like two cuts of the movie. Just take them out and have them as a DVD.
Oh, extra. Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
Just like, do you like Florence? I'm like, yeah, I do. And then just have that bit, and then yeah, like then have it as a 12A for the rest of the
movie. Then you go watch that bit on your own in a separate room. Yeah, it's a weird one to end on. I feel like we've got to like go to a different point now, because we can't end on.
Yeah, we have to talk for another 10 minutes.
Well, it's also I don't want to end on the only slight negative. I have another small positive. Again, just talking about cast, is like, I loved seeing Josh Hartnett again in this film, because yeah. I feel like he disappeared for like years. And we now see him in Black Mirror and this, and it was just a great reminder of, like, he's fucking awesome, man. Like, put him as the lead in a horror film, please. Like, he's so good.
I just want him as a lead in something.
Yeah.
Like, in a movie, because he is...
Oh, I want him as, like, a creepy, like, you know, maniac-level killer. Like, a serial killer that we're following. Like, yeah. I think he's great.
Oh, that'd be great. But I just think as well, like, that was the thing, because, like, with Josh Hartnett, I was like, you know... When he pops up in the movie, I was like, hang on, that's your father. I was like, hang on a second. And that happened like so many
times. Oh, it's hilarious, isn't it? It almost is for comedic effect when they go, here's an A-list actor that pops up who doesn't even speak in a scene. Like, it's so funny.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing, that, like, you know, you're watching this, you're watching this movie, and yeah, you're just kind of like blown away by, like, yeah, you're suddenly an hour and a half in, you have an actor pop up that just hasn't been in the rest of the movie, and you're like, well, you're normally the lead, mate, you know, and you're just in this one scene. it is crazy.
Yeah, it really is. But yeah, this movie is like I say, it's difficult to talk about. I think we've done a good job of it, but it's an experience would be my final point. Yeah. Was that you can't compare this to many normal films. No. It's something that I'm glad exists, and I'm super glad I experienced it. I don't know when I'm ever going to be in the mood for something like this again. It's funny, because the second it ended, I was like, oh, I liked that, but I don't think I'd ever watch it again. But then even a few days later, now I'm like, no, I would watch this again. Like, not straight away, but like, I will watch this again.
It has to be the right circumstance, doesn't it?
Yeah, like, it's going to be harder at home, because the cinema's the perfect way to experience this. You need to carve out the time. You need to not be thinking about the time and not worrying about other things. And you need to just go in, and almost like what you want most films to be, in the sense of, you have to switch your brain off. You can't be thinking about anything else watching Oppenheimer. Like, you will not be able to follow it. There's just too much going on, and even then you'll struggle.
I want to sit there with like Wikipedia though, and just like every time a character pops up, just pause it and then spend like half an hour researching.
Yeah,
them. Like, that's going to be my next time watching it. That's where it's going to be 12 hours.
Well, the first 30 minutes when he's sort of in academia, and it's like, we see Kenneth Branagh's character, who's this famous physicist. We see Heisenberg, don't we? We see, you know, all of these different names. And
yeah, I just want to pause and be like, who is, I can't remember the Kenneth Branagh character name, but I want to just Google him and be like, oh, okay. What the fuck did he do? What did he do?
He's a Danish. Like, oh, okay. He's a Danish physicist that won the Nobel Peace Prize. Like, there's, again, everyone has such an interesting backstory.
Yeah, they're like, oh yeah, he just invented, like, I don't know, something obscene that we use every day now. I'm like, oh, okay, sweet. And he was in the movie for like, you know, 10 minutes.
Yeah. There's just, I didn't feel
like, in two scenes.
Casey Affleck's character's so good in this film as well. Like, there's so many people in this film that are all just amazing.
Yeah, well, when you said about, you know, people not talking, obviously, like, Rami Malek, like, he just kind of, like, pops up, and he's just, like, there in the background grinning in the scene when he first pops up, and I'm like, is that it? And then, like he comes back in the final parts of the movie, and I'm like, yeah, you know, this guy is leading movies, and he's just like 2.5 hours into the Nolan movie, just grinning away in the background.
Yeah, it's crazy. We've got like Matthew Modine from Stranger Things is in this as well. Yeah. Like, there's so many people. Like, it's one of my favorite casts ever assembled, I think, because I love everyone in this film. Like, yeah. There's like 20 actors that I all collectively liked anyway, and they're all brilliant in this film.
I think that's the thing, that normally when you have a big ensemble like this, there'll be someone pop up where you're just like, they can give a good performance or whatever, but I'm like, oh, I just don't really like you normally.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't want to, like, throw any actor under the bus. I can't even really think of anyone, but, like, sometimes you just watch something and then, like, yeah, massively into it. Yeah, someone pops up and you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, really? But this one just kind of, like, it kept giving us bangers every time.
Yeah, like, someone like Jason Clarke's like that, where, like, I love him every time I see him. And he's been in a lot of shit that I don't like. And I'm always, like, bummed. Like, I feel like Matt Smith would have been, like, the icing on the cake for a movie like this.
Yeah,
but because he's so good. And obviously, we've seen him in some amazing stuff, obviously. But, like, he's in some stuff that's really not good as well. And so I feel like, this movie's so collectively awesome that when you know you've got an actor like that you already love, you know that this is just going to be so terrific, because they're going to be given a role that suits them perfectly, and they're going to absolutely knock it out of the park just like everyone else has. Because I do want to mention, just end briefly, like, Florence is great in this film, like, acting wise, and I think she really gets across the kind of desperation, the kind of how torn she is in the relationship, and certainly the finale of her character is really brutal, and I think she gets across that performance brilliantly as well. And like you rightly mentioned as well, like, Emily Blunt as Kitty is so good as well. Like, it's just, you could just talk for days about just the cast.
I think that's it with Florence's character, though, because that final scene with her and Oppenheimer, like, the once you get past the fact that they're just sitting there nude in a very awkward way, like, the actual tension that they're talking about in that, and, like, the fact that, like, it was kind of explicit to me that she was basically asking for help, and he was, you know, and he was basically like, I can't do this shit anymore. Yeah. I gotta save the world. Like, I can't keep saving you. Like, you gotta just sort your own shit out. And he knew when he walked out of that room what was probably gonna happen. And that's why it hit him so hard. Because he's like, I can't. Like, I've got other shit going on now. I'm not just, like, teaching a class.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry. You know, and I really thought that was well executed for her character, and, like, that development, which is what we didn't get earlier on in the film.
For sure. But yeah, I think this, like I said, you know, as a conclusion, like, this really is like an experience that it's hard to kind of think about it like a traditional film. I think if you are trying to compare this to other Nolan movies, I don't see the point in it, because it's so different. Yeah. I think it is.
You can't compare it to anything.
No, like, it's. It almost is what I wish every documentary was, you know, where it's like, it's telling you a real life story, but in the most interesting and fascinating ways. And it's told by one of the best directors in the world with some of the best actors in the world, and told in such a gorgeous, stunning way that you can't really ask anything more of this. I think that's my biggest takeaway, is that if you were trying to create the perfect film about the life and death of Oppenheimer, I don't know how you could possibly make it any better than this without overstepping the mark and being like, oh yeah, well, there was this one time when a bunch of, you know, Nazis were trying to recruit him, so he had to have this, like, 5-hour car chase to leave the country. Like, that's what would happen. And it's like,
Nazi spy got into the camp, Hitler came and visited the States,
you know,
and it's just like, no.
And it's like,
no.
And then they had this side project where they were making werewolves and shit. Like, it was proper crazy. And, like, yeah, that'd be,
hey man, Overlord was a good movie.
It's like, that'd be super, that'd be great, that'd be more horror for us, but, like, it wouldn't be true. And I do feel like, whilst I was thoroughly entertained, I feel like I genuinely learned so much from this film, and it's made me think about this a lot. Like, I think this stuff's fucking terrifying anyway, but, like, I still, that was my conclusion when the movie ends, which I do think, not to fully, I don't want to spoil it, but I think the last, like, 5 minutes of this movie is so exceptional, where it's worth watching the 3 hours before just to see that last 5 minutes, and to specifically see Killian, just his crown jewel and his acting in that final moment, because that was me, when that movie ended, I was like, why is the Earth still? I was like, why is the Earth still here? I'm like, yeah. I just watched a movie that somehow exists, telling me how this all ended, and yet we're still here. Like, what's that all about? And it's a crazy crisis, like self crisis, to have after watching what's supposed to be a blockbuster.
You're right in the. I had this moment in like the last few minutes of the movie, and I'm really glad you mentioned it because I forgot about it because it was too real. Mm. Where as these last few minutes were going on, I genuinely sat there thinking, fuck, the world's gonna end when this movie ends. Yeah. Like, I genuinely was sat there and was like, I shouldn't be here. I should be with people, like, you know, that, like, This is it. Yeah. Like, when this, I genuinely had like that sense of like the world was ending, like with this movie. Like, it really did bring that thought home, because you are just like, yeah, that's it's inevitable.
And that's what's so crazy. Again, this isn't Armageddon. This isn't a big blockbuster about the end of the world. It's about people having conversations about theory. But the reason why it's so scary is because it's so real. Like, this is actually what's happened. And, you know, not to get too kind of crazy, but like, we have actual wars going on in Europe not that far from us right now, and the people in that war have access to these weapons. Like, that's a reality.
Just wait. You just got to wait until the AI get control of it, mate, and then rip.
Yeah, and then that brings us back to Mission Impossible. Lovely.
I was going Terminator, but fine, whatever.
Like, it's been a great, like, we kind of lamented film in general this year, and whilst it hasn't obviously helped the horror scene, I can't help but remark that I've easily seen the best two movies this year in the last 2 weeks. Yeah. Like, Oppenheimer and Mission Impossible is so unbelievably good that everyone should go see them, and I want to see them both. They again, like, it's just... It saved this year, because I think even now when I look back on 2023, I've already got two movies that immediately I'll jump out and be like, those are the two. But yeah, great times. Have you got any sort of closing thoughts on the old Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I do not recommend this as a horror movie. 1 out of 10.
Yeah, it was weird. We kind of joked last week, because people were saying, like, it's rated R.
You made me believe that it was
Christopher Nolan has said some stuff, man, where he was like, you know, some of it is. And I do think the jump scares, which are clearly in here, are his attempt at making horror. But, like, no, this isn't a horror movie. I don't know what the hell this is. I don't even want to try and categorize it. It's just a 3-hour experience that I would highly recommend to anyone who has any interest in anything. Like, it's so good on any level. But yeah, that is our random but fun discussion on Oppenheimer. I will take a quick break and we will be right back. So yeah, that is it for another week. Bit of a different one this week, but always enjoyable. So we'll be back to the grind, though, because we have got cinema horror for the next couple of weeks, actually. So yeah, we've got stuff on demand just ready to go, but we won't need that for at least a few more weeks, because we've got Talk to Me this weekend, which should be an interesting one. Always nice to see an original horror IP on the big screen, because we can't ever overstate how rare that is these days. So that's cool.
I'm not against this one as well. No. Like, the idea of it seems, you know, different enough in the spooky wheelhouse where I'm like, okay, I need to just stop talking shit and just try to enjoy this movie that's a bit different.
Yeah, like, I'm there because of the fact that I'm at such a level now where my bar is so low for horror that, like, I need if I see a good film, I'm going to be talking it up like crazy, like, because I'm just at that level where I want to love something. So, like, I need to just see a good horror film at the cinema and it'll be in my top five for this year. So I'm ready for that. But I also am with you of, like, there's no point fighting it. We know what the next 3 months is ahead of us. So this is pointless us being negative and going into it every week being like, we don't like these types of films, and just, you know, see what happens. So it's definitely the different enough, but even the ones like The Nun 2, I'm not going to like hold it against it. I'm going to try and enjoy it for what it is. But then after that, funny enough, we do have a sequel, which God knows how this is going to go, because The Meg 2 is finally here. After the many years of the so many fans around the world waiting for this one.
I was trying to figure out what when you said we're at the cinema for 2 weeks.
Yeah, like, I knew for a fact that you didn't know this movie was this close.
I know, I knew it was this close. So I was just hoping it would pass us by.
Again, I'm down for this shit. Like, again, the bar for horror is low, man. Like, so if you can give me a fun movie like what Cocaine Bear was, like, I will take that. I just want fun at this point. I don't need the next Saint Maud, because I look at our upcoming schedule and I don't see where the next Saint Maud or Last Night in Soho is going to come from. So I just want fun at this point. But yeah, good times ahead. But anyway, that was episode 357. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll see you again very soon.
See you later, everyone. Mainly because I never could. How could I start?